Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Shweta Mishra, your host, and today we are talking about the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on pregnant women and those seeking infertility treatments with our eminent experts, Dr. Cindy Duke and Dr. Amy. Dr. Duke is a reproductive endocrinologist and clinical assistant professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and she is also a PhD-trained and research award-winning virologist, whose work has centered on the interplay of viruses with the human immune system. Dr. Amy on the panel is a Harvard-educated board-certified OBGYN specializing in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. She is one of America's most renowned fertility doctors, famously known as the Egg Whisperer. I welcome you to Cure Talks, Dr. Amy and Dr. Duke. It's my pleasure to have you both here to talk about the care of those who are already pregnant in COVID times and clear the air around the ASRM updates on the care of patients who are in the middle of infertility treatments, something that all who are fighting with infertility are really confused and worried about. On the panel to guide the discussion, we have our infertility patient advocates, Amy Schmidt-Zuck and Valerie Landis. Amy is an emergency medicine physician who has personally struggled with infertility for 5 years and has had her current treatments put on hold during COVID. And Valerie Landis has been working in the women's healthcare field for the last decade, focusing on guiding women through the complexities of fertility decisions. I welcome you to the show, Amy and Valerie, and thank you for joining the panel today. Before we begin, I would like to tell our audience that we will be discussing questions sent in via email in the last few minutes of the show, so you can email your questions to me at shweta@trialx.com or post them on the page where you're listening to the show right now, and we will answer them based on the availability of time. So I'll begin with you, Dr. Amy. As the COVID-19 pandemic began to affect lives around the world, out of an abundance of caution, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, the ASRM Task Force, released a mandate on March 17th recommending fertility clinics to suspend all new fertility treatments, cancel embryo transfers, and suspend all elective surgeries. A second update was released on April 13th, and recently on April 24th, update number 3 was released. So how has the advisory changed since this whole saga of the COVID-19 outbreak began in January? And what has been the most important concerns of the ASRM task force framing these advisories? I would really appreciate if you could take us through the summary of the first two mandates and the highlights of the new update, number 3, for our audience.
Absolutely. So the first update, as you mentioned, around March 30th, recommended suspension or putting on pause all new treatment cycles, including, for example, ovulation induction, IUIs, IVF, including retrievals and frozen embryo transfers, as well as non-urgent embryo and egg freezing, and a strong consideration for canceling all embryo transfers, regardless of whether they were fresh or prolly. We need to have continued care for patients who are almost at the point of their egg retrieval for obvious reasons because of, you know, medical situations that can occur if you're in cycle, very swollen, and you need to retrieve those eggs. And I also recommended suspending all elective surgeries and non-urgent diagnostic procedures and to minimize all in-person interactions and to increase utilization of telehealth. And the reason for that was because we didn't know what was going on. And obviously there was this principle out there that is among all doctors that we need to protect the public health of our patients and our communities. And we know from stories out of Italy and Spain that there were shortages of PPE and fertility clinics were loaning ventilators to hospitals. And because we just didn't know what was happening at the time, it is very understandable that the task force made these recommendations. And the recommendations were made based on the principles of public health. And then there was an update on April 13th that, you know, my takeaway from it was that they recognized that infertility care was an essential service, but they still strongly recommended putting a pause on treatment. And then the latest recommendation, which was a beautifully written document, April 24th, really outlined in a very careful way how clinics can start providing care in a very appropriate way based on what's going on in their community. So they basically gave us a very nice document that gave a risk assessment outlining which patients we should be taking care of, how to mitigate risk for our staff and our patients, as well as how to physically distance, sanitize surfaces in our own clinics. So this allows physicians such as myself to resume caring for patients who need this essential care. So it was a very nicely written document. I'm so happy to have had it. And it's something that patients can read online as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, thank you for that comprehensive overview, Dr. Amy, and that was really very helpful. I will now move on to Dr. Duke. Dr. Duke, some studies quote that viruses rarely cross the placental barrier, and in utero fetal viral infections are rare. I wanted to ask you, in the past, have we seen viral infections that have been fatal for a pregnant mother and the developing embryo, and how is this coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 different from them in terms of virulence? And what are the chances of the fetus getting infected with COVID if the mom is infected? Have we found something new over the last couple of months? Have we been able to gather some data on this?
I think the first thing that I'd like every single patient who's out there to hear is that to date, there has not been a single reported case of a baby becoming infected, a fetus, while mom is pregnant if she were to become infected with SARS-CoV-2. Now, there are many concerns out there about viruses, viral infections, and the proverbial question is, can a virus cross the placental barrier? And the short answer is yes, certain viruses can. SARS-CoV-2 does not appear to be one of those. And in fact, the coronaviruses as a family of viruses are not known to cross the placenta. Now, there are viruses, though, mm-hmm. that cross the placenta, and those include measles, mumps, rubella, HIV. Some herpes viruses can cross the placenta. And so those are the viruses in particular that we emphasize for moms. A cytomegalovirus is another one, where we recommend that the person who will be carrying the pregnancy should be vaccinated and have a robust immune response to these viruses before pregnancy so that their immune system can then protect the growing pregnancy and prevent that virus from crossing the placenta. However, SARS-CoV-2 is not considered one of those viruses. And indeed, so far, when you look at the research that's coming out, there is no report of a single fetus in utero being infected. Now, there are some studies that suggest the placenta may be infected, but not actually crossing the placenta to the embryo. And I have some theories about that. One is the primary way that this virus infects is via rest tissue. And so instead of a fetus doesn't get its oxygen from breathing, as a matter of fact, its respiratory system isn't really developed until just before birth. And so the cells that the virus typically infects are not developed in a fetus. And I really wanted to share that to give further reassurance to those who are listening about the pathogenesis and how this virus's virulence works.
Sure. Okay, so to my follow-up question, so are there, have you found in over the last couple of months some data that we did not know 2 months back from new studies or something?
Well, you know, there are a couple of studies that have come out so far that have been giving us a number of reassurances as it relates to pregnancy and those who are attempting pregnancy. So to date, we know that there are no viral particles, meaning no evidence of virus in breast milk, nor is it in semen,
right.
And it's not in the testicle. That's really reassuring because for many people, those even infertility patients who, while their treatments were on pause, were still attempting to try to conceive from home, that would have been a concern. And so that was reassuring information to receive. In addition, there does not appear to be any evidence, even in embryos that were tested, infection of the embryos. And so that's also reassuring. So while it's still a new virus to us. We only learned about it back in December. Remember, gestation is 9 months. So far, all of the information
right.
that we're seeing is very reassuring in general. Now, the one group of women that we're concerned about are those who have underlying conditions such as diabetes, or those who may have developed diabetes during pregnancy
right.
or high blood pressure. And that may increase your risk for developing COVID-19 severity of illness versus someone who does not have that underlying issue.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, Dr. Duke, what suggestion would you give to patients who are pregnant and having flu-like symptoms, and how would your advice be different for them in these COVID times compared to if someone was pregnant and had a normal flu in pre-COVID times?
Yes. You know, my advice is actually very similar, which is the first thing to do is call your doctor, use telemedicine. Both the flu, as in influenza, and COVID-2 are highly infectious and transmissible. And so while I would want both patients to be evaluated, I would really encourage them first to call their doctor, go over the symptoms so that the doctor can determine the best place to send them. They will need to be evaluated, but the doctor can determine where they need to be evaluated. I will encourage that patient to wear a mask before leaving the house so that they protect themselves but also others from their potential mm-hmm. infection. I would reassure them the good news is the sooner you determine that you have flu symptoms, the better it is to call your doctor, particularly if it turns out to be influenza, because we do have effective treatment for influenza if we can initiate it early. There are medications that we can prescribe. And so if you're having flu-like symptoms, I would recommend calling your doctor right away. If they can see you via telemedicine, that would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, many times, depending on where you are in your pregnancy, if you're in your second, third trimester, they may also want you to come in so they can assess how the fetus is doing.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Thank you so much for that advice. Dr. Amy, coming back to you. So wanted to ask, when this whole thing starts to come back on track, and I believe in many of the states have decided to start their infertility treatments starting May 1, that is today. Of course, it is not clear up to what extent, but what special precautions will be needed going further while undergoing procedures like ICSI to ensure the safety of the embryos being formed? Because I'm sure as much as we all will be happy when infertility treatments get back on track, we will also be worried about the safety of the embryos, the safety of eggs and sperms in storage. So can you comment on that?
I can, and that's a very common question I'm getting, is how do I know that my embryos mm-hmm. won't catch COVID, and I can reassure people and tell them they won't. And there are studies, just like Dr. Duke mentioned, that are now published, and I can share with you a study that's looked at the virus in semen, and they have not found any. So
mm-hmm.
we know it's not going to be in sperm, because they've also done testicular aspirations. And I feel sorry for those guys who went through that, but I guess it's for a good cause
right.
because it answers that question. And so it doesn't seem, of course, we don't know everything, but it doesn't seem like the embryo can catch it in the same, you know, and we know that from other things like HIV, for example. So you take a single sperm cell and you inject it into the egg, the embryo does not then carry that disease HIV.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Thanks for that answer. It definitely is reassuring for many. With that, I'll just now move on to our panel questions, and I'll invite Amy now. Amy Schmidt-Zuk is an emergency physician who herself is struggling with infertility, and she is currently now leading a support group of over 1,600 physician women with infertility, and recently started the Infertility Advocacy Alliance to promote action-based advocacy for infertility rights. Amy, you are on. Please ask your questions.
Hi. I just want to say hi to Dr. Amy and to Dr. Duke, and we appreciate their time. So the first question for Dr. Amy is that I'm hearing from some of the physician women that are in the support group with me that they are concerned that going forward with their treatment might be put on hold due to their work with high-risk COVID patients, those kind of doctors, nurses, techs that are on the front lines. Is there a different type of guideline that addresses frontline workers, or are they using the same kind of risk profile for those as they are for patients that, say, aren't in medicine?
Hi, Amy. I love that I get to talk to you, and I feel like I should be calling you Dr. Amy, too. If you're going to call me Dr. Amy, I'm calling you Dr. Amy back. So, you know, the way I think about it is every client's going to be different. You know what I mean? And I do share that concern that some clinics will be prejudiced against patients who are physicians, nurses, techs working in the ER and exposed to potentially high-risk patients. And that is the reality. I mean, I've seen the questionnaires that some of the clinics put out there where the first three lines are, you know, the questions like, do you work in a hospital? Have you been exposed to a COVID patient? And if your answer is yes, you may not be allowed to move forward with treatment. And I think that's a real concern, and patients need to ask their clinic what they can do to potentially still move forward with treatment or find a clinic that will help them. And we know there is tests that you can do. The hospital right here next to me, mm-hmm. they do COVID tests. I get a 24-hour turnaround time. So that is potentially one strategy that clinics can use to test their healthcare workers. They feel really comfortable helping those people. And I feel like it is incredibly unfair for these people who have put their lives on hold and are helping people in this pandemic to then also tell them they have to put their family goals on hold. And, you know, I just won't do that for people, but I can certainly understand why that's a concern. And I haven't seen a guideline out there yet.
Okay.
And I feel the same way. I feel the same way.
Thank you, Dr. Duke. I appreciate that. I know it's a huge concern for some of the doctors, like I said, that are worried, you know, should they take a leave of absence, or, you know, how are they supposed to now fit this in on top of everything else? It's just really confusing for them personally. The second question I have is when the guidelines first came out, the initial thought was to help to flatten the curve, let everybody catch up, get PPE, make sure that the hospitals locally don't get overwhelmed. Now some of it seems to be leaning towards preventing pregnancy, and in that vein, I've seen that a lot of the REIs are planning to start retrievals with freeze-alls, but are not doing FETs or even at some points hysteroscopies or polyp removals, which is leaving a lot of the women in a lurch. Is there data as to why they're picking or some clinics are picking one versus other, or is that just a personal risk assessment? And how do you feel about limiting it to freeze-all cycles for patients at this point?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is the freeze-all cycles, you're limiting the in and out of patients in and out of the practice, right? So if you're doing a fresh embryo transfer, you're seeing that patient for her pregnancy, obviously the transfer after the egg retrieval, her pregnancy test, and then her OB ultrasound. So there's more in and out of patients from your clinic. And I get it. Maybe in certain parts of the country, that's less desirable. But I personally feel like American College of OBGYN has not come out and said that women should stop trying to get pregnant in this country. So it's incredibly unfair, in my humble opinion, to not allow women to do an embryo transfer if the patient and doctor thinks that it is safe. You know, we know with fresh embryo transfers after IVF, sometimes patients can be at higher risk of things like ovarian hyperstimulation, especially if you're transferring two embryos. You know, that carries risk as well, with a twin pregnancy being higher risk. So I feel like you should do what's lower risk, but do, you know, make a sensible decision for yourself. You know, don't let the pandemic put your fertility goals on hold, and still move forward with your plans if you and your doctor think that it's right for you. As far as polyp surgeries, again, it's the same thing. You know, depending on where you live, you know, some surgery centers are not in a big hospital setting, and then they're allowing patients to do polyp removal so that you can move forward with an egg retrieval and a transfer. So I do see that, you know, doing that right now in the current environment that we're in with COVID, I think in my community, for example, it's very acceptable. So I am not limiting patients to freeze-all cycles. They still get the opportunity to do a fresh transfer if it makes sense for us. And I have a fresh transfer scheduled here soon, and I'm very excited to be able to do that for her. And I'm so lucky too, because I know that not everyone has the opportunity to do that because of the clinic, the community, the government guidelines where they live, but we can here in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic. I mean, I just want to say as a patient, you know, that we genuinely appreciate and know that our physicians are doing things with our best, you know, health and outcomes in mind. So I do appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And moving on for Dr. Duke, hello.
Hello.
How are you doing? I am so impressed by everything you've said so far. So I genuinely appreciate you being here. What is the most recent evidence for outcomes of COVID infections in pregnant women and the fetuses? You spoke earlier that there has not been an infected fetus or newborn that you have seen other than the placental data. I guess throwing in there at the same time, why do you think that there is not more data from other countries where this has been going on for longer? You know, Zika, everybody kind of got together and put out recommendations, but here it's been really spotty. And I know some countries we maybe don't have the best relationship with, but through scientific methods and channels, I feel like we should have more.
Yes.
What do you feel on that?
I agree. The data so far coming out is limited and preliminary. And again, the first is because if we think of a gestation, it's 9 months. But even if we think of the first hardest hit place, which is Wuhan, China, they still haven't had someone who's conceived and gone through an entire pregnancy in the age of COVID-19 yet. So far, a lot of the information that we're seeing either has to do with what's happening in the third trimester and data related to the few miscarriages that seem to be related to someone's COVID-19 infection. What I would say, though, in all the information that's coming out so far, including preliminary data now from the United States and New York City in particular, which is especially hard hit, as we know, the data is favorable. So what we know first and foremost is pregnant women are not at any more increased risk for becoming infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus when compared to other women in the general population who are not pregnant. Secondly, we know that generally healthy pregnant women also do very well, even if they became infected with COVID. The numbers that end up in the intensive care unit or requiring ventilators to help them breathe are really low. And so far, the case reports that do show the most severe in terms of morbidity happen to be who we would have expected based on the general data, which is women with underlying health conditions like diabetes, etc. In terms of the babies born, the neonates are doing really well. We're seeing that babies, if they're born, a few have tested positive subsequent to birth, but in those neonates, they still do quite well. We do see that most people who are infected with the virus and have developed the disease, COVID-19, meaning symptomatic, if they are delivered, the delivery mode tends to be cesarean, but it's not because COVID itself is requiring a cesarean delivery. It's that usually mom's symptoms, her clinical symptoms, clinical picture, meaning her difficulty breathing, difficulty getting oxygen to herself and the baby, can prompt the need for an emergency delivery, one, to rescue the fetus, but also to help mom recover sooner. And so the rates of cesarean are higher in those particular severely ill COVID patients. But that said, there are many patients who are coronavirus positive who are delivering vaginally. There are babies, birthing centers. There's no guideline that says if you're positive for coronavirus, you're now mandated to have a cesarean. And I think it's important that patients hear that because there have been some unfounded rumors being spread that suggested if someone went to a hospital and tested positive, they're going to have a cesarean. And that's not true. It's only when indicated. And it's important to point that out. But overall, the results so far are favorable. That said, we still don't have a full pregnancy yet because the gestation is, you know, 40 weeks. We haven't really had a lot of, it hasn't been 40 weeks since we first discovered that there's this virus and it causes a disease called COVID.
Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am now going to pass it off to Valerie for her questions to you guys.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining the call today. I have a couple of key questions. You know, it's Dr. Amy, if you don't mind going first. You know, it's a really confusing time right now with patients and having mixed messages. So what are some key actions or activities patients can do to stay safe while trying to get pregnant, either at home or the fertility clinic if theirs are open in their area? What are some key things that they can do to actively get pregnant and stay safe at the same time?
I mean, I think that following the guidelines of whatever city or county or state that you're in is really important. You know, it is a confusing time. There's, you know, patients who are in treatment, they're in a fertility fog or estrogen fog when you're on hormones. And now on top of that, a lot of patients are in a COVID fog because everything just seems so confusing with what we're hearing. But, as far as how to stay safe while trying naturally is concerned, I just feel like it's important to talk to your doctor and they know you. And if you have a higher risk because of your medical problems or the work that you do, reconsider trying naturally right now. Same thing with your fertility doctor. Talk to them about your age, your fertility levels. And if it seems like it makes sense to maybe wait a couple months, do so in your certain, you know, in your own situation, and then talk to your doctor about when to time sex, you know, how to monitor ovulation, for example. Should you take progesterone as another example? So there are things that you can do at home as you wait, and that's very frustrating, I know, to hear when you're, you know, hoping for something that will give you a much higher chance of pregnancy like IVF, but there's certainly things that you can do to still try and get pregnant at home, stay safe, with the help of your OBGYN or fertility doctor. You know, some of the things that I'm doing right now for patients who aren't quite ready to do IVF, but they want to, but we're on pause, is, for example, prescribing fertility pills, and then they're, you know, trying at home.
Great. Thank you for that help. Dr. Duke, if a patient or their partner tests positive for COVID-19 and they contract it either now or in the future, does that impact their fertility? And how long after a positive test should they wait to anticipate trying to get pregnant if they aren't currently pregnant?
At present, we don't have any evidence that suggests coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 infection causes any negative impact on, say, your egg count or your fallopian tubes or your womb or on sperm. We don't have such evidence. But I also have to be honest in that no one's directly looked at that yet. But I would tell you, knowing what we know about the family of coronaviruses in terms of MERS, which is Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, and SARS, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome, both of which were prevalent and scary back in the early 2000s, we did not see any negative impacts from those infections on sperm counts, et cetera, in the long term. Now, in the short term, if someone is sick, when your immune system is fighting off a virus, your body basically tends to decide, I have to delegate systems here. And so reproduction sort of falls back in terms of the priorities for your body. And so in the short term, when someone's sick, for example, a guy, his sperm production may drop. And so he may see that with a temporary fall in sperm counts in maybe the 2 to 3 months following his infection. And so he may have a temporary drop, but it's expected to rebound once he's better. And we see that with generally any viral infection, including the flu or the common cold. You may see increased white blood cells or immune cells in a semen sample, for example, while the person's sick or still fighting off their infection. But usually once the infection is cleared and the testicles are back in terms of top priority for reproduction, the sperm counts bounce back. And for a guy, he is ready to go again. For women, we've never truly seen a direct impact on viral infections and egg counts, and that's because, as we know, your eggs are formed before you're born. And so what we, and they're not actively dividing either in terms of the cells. And so usually, again, we recommend those getting better. We know that the viral particles can be in saliva. And so if you're positive or your partner's positive, you want to practice, you know, as much social physical distancing as you can, and precautions. But once you're better and you're cleared, or what we have, a, you know, you have a test of cure, being either serology or your nasal pharyngeal test is negative, then you should be clear to start again. And certainly at my clinic, that's what I'm doing with patients who previously tested positive or had high exposure. I'm testing them before we proceed with treatments.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Duke. Dr. Amy, are there some good tips for patients to get through this difficult time, whether they're either dealing with depression or, you know, due to the pandemic, exercise, those key things to stay mentally strong while they wait for the pandemic to end and be able to start treatments again if their clinic or area isn't allowing that at this time? Do you have any key things they can do while the pandemic's going on and they're sitting at home to be able to cope with the crisis?
Absolutely. And this is what I use in my daily life. I mean, being a fertility doctor isn't just, you know, filled with happy phone calls. It's dealing with really stressful situations all day long and trying to help people cope with some of the hardest things that they've ever faced. And so some of the things I tell my patients, and this sounds really cheesy and lame, but I'm going to tell you anyways, because this is what I think is important for people to know, is to have a happy place. I mean, literally find it, so that whenever you're feeling really anxious and desperate, you just find a peaceful place you can go in your head, because these active thoughts that come in, that it's the end of the world, I'm never going to get pregnant, I'm never going to, you know, why me, why now? You got to replace it, and you got to find peace, because you can't let, you know, I tell my patients, you can't let infertility take away your joy, and you sure as heck can't let the pandemic take away your joy either. So happy place. The next thing is a fight song. So find music that invigorates you, you know, get a nice headset, find some streaming service that you really love, and just dance. And that's, you know, a tip that I give my patients too. And then the other thing is find a mantra. So pick a phrase that works for you, and you can go online, like positive quotes, you know, Google it, and find a quote that really resonates for yourself that you can just, you know, repeat and repeat and repeat until you don't have to think about it. It just automatically comes into your head. And then the other thing is talk to people, Zoom with people. I mean, at least 1 to 2 people a day. Don't just click like on Facebook. Don't just like an Instagram post. Really connect. Take the time to do a video call, at least 1 or 2 a day, so that you're feeling socially connected with people, and really find someone who will just let you just vent and listen and not judge and be like, well, what about all these other people in the world? You know, you want someone to really, you know, it's okay to feel bad about what's going on in the world, and it's okay to also feel bad about what's going on with you. So those are the things that I tell my patients, and I think that they help people. And of course, you know, moving and exercising and being outside, if you can, wherever you live, is really helpful too.
Thanks, Dr. Amy. That's really helpful advice, especially when you see pregnancy announcements or happy other events happening during this time and patients are struggling with the same problem they've been maybe struggling with for privately or publicly for some time. So thanks for that advice. Dr. Duke, you know, we've talked a lot with you about if patients are positive and if there's any reoccurring with their partner testing positive, but can we talk a little bit more about if the virus can be passed on to the baby, if there's risks from pregnant women that are already pregnant getting COVID, what that could do to their pregnancy, or if they should postpone their care for a later date, or what your recommendations are regarding the outbreak?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say my biggest recommendation is try to avoid becoming infected, which means wearing a mask whenever you are outdoors, practicing physical distancing. If you are pregnant and work in a high-risk zone, such as a healthcare worker, I strongly encourage what the CDC has recommended, which is talking with your supervisors to minimize your exposure, perhaps taking you away from direct patient care if that were possible. I know for some of our pregnant doctors, they're the only specialist or expert in their area where they're working. But if it were possible for you to have backup, then maybe removing you from direct patient care during this time will be strongly recommended. And that's because mostly about what we know as it relates to the pathogenesis, the disease process of COVID-19. And it's manifesting differently in different patients. We do not yet understand fully what it is about certain patients' medical histories, maybe their prior infection histories, that leads to them having what we call an exaggerated response to the virus. And so if you can avoid it altogether, that would really be the best. So if you can maybe be switched, like I said, if you're high risk, can you telecommute? Can you maybe, if you're a healthcare worker, instead of direct patient care, can you go to something that's more administrative, et cetera? Where possible. But other things that you can do would be, again, if you think you're having symptoms, calling your doctor right away, getting that testing done, having the fetus checked out with a, you know, a non-distress test, et cetera, depending on where you are in the pregnancy. Those are some of the precautions. Other precautions I would say is if you live with someone who is high risk for exposure and or infection, considering physical distancing, even within your own social or home situation, that helps to decrease your risk as well. Other than that, really, you know, taking care of your general health. If you have underlying diabetes, underlying heart disease, blood pressure issues, now is the time to make sure you're checking your blood sugars, taking your medications, taking your insulin if it's prescribed. This is the time to be really diligent, especially so, about your underlying medical health, taking your prenatal vitamin, et cetera, as a preventive measure for shoring up your own immune system.
Oh, that's great advice. Yeah, those little things like your fertility meds and vitamins and
yes,
smoothies and fertility-focused foods are
mm-hmm.
good things to do at home since you are
yes.
stuck at home or safe at home.
Absolutely.
Amy,
and one more
there...
thing, sorry.
Yes.
And quitting smoking if you smoke.
Yeah, that's very key, right? It seems pretty basic that those would be the key things you would do to get pregnant in normal circumstances, not just an epidemic like the COVID-19 struggle. But Dr. Amy, is there any pros or cons that you would suggest or talk about for IVF and fertility treatments since they are being reconsidered as elective, and non-elective, and more essential Medicare care that's being done right now? To clear up any confusion on what's safe, like the pros and cons?
Well, I mean, the pros of cycling right now is people don't have to tell their bosses because everyone's home. I mean, that's the pro. I mean, a lot of my patients are so happy. They're like, this is the best time. You know, it's almost like my teachers mm-hmm. who are on vacation for spring break or the summertime. Like, they're so happy that they don't have to allow the treatment to interfere
True.
With their work schedule. You know, so the cons of the treatment are just a lot of clinics, and that's just how it is they're just not allowing partners, support people inside the office, and that's really stressful for some people where they really like to have that person there for them, and I get it. So that's the biggest con right now is just having support people. I think that's probably the main con. Of course, the biggest con of all is that not having access to all types of treatment that you need at your clinic because of the limited resources potentially that are there.
Great, thank you. And Dr. Duke, you know, for those struggling or possibly losing their jobs at this time, is there any financial resources that you know of or ways that patients can cover this if, for example, they lose their health insurance that may be covered fertility benefits
mm-hmm.
or any suggestions that you would have the patients ask help for the clinics during this like extraordinary time?
Yes. So one of the first things I would say is if you are furloughed or losing your job, there's something called COBRA that you should look into, first of all, where you can usually extend your fertility benefits, your health benefits by up to 90 days. And while it has some out-of-pocket costs, so that might be a way to help you complete your fertility treatments before your benefits are gone if you had fertility benefits through your employer. So that's one. The other is if you're in the job market, there are a number of employers out there, way more now than even 4 years ago, who currently provide fertility benefits. And so if you're someone for whom cost and affordability is an concern, I would encourage you to inquire about the benefits package and whether fertility benefits are part of the benefits package. I would tell you for myself, I have patients who call in and ask me what are the fertility codes, because there are special codes that we have to send to insurance in order to get fertility services covered. And so patients take those codes and they contact their potential future employer, for example, or if they're in the market to switch insurance, and say, can you find out if my plan, the proposed plan for me, will cover these codes, or are there other plans available that I can consider that will cover these codes? So that's one. But there are also grants out there. And so there are a number of funding agencies, number of nonprofits that have grants, and those range from some that are specific to people of certain religious backgrounds, to people of certain ethnic backgrounds, and then to those who have different economic situations. And actually, I, shameless plug, have a resource book coming out next week. It's an ebook, and it has an entire chapter all about this that will have all of this information as well. And I encourage people to look into it because, yes, this is a concern. We have up to 30% of people in some jurisdictions across the United States who are no longer working. And so affordability and insurance benefits may be a concern, but there are lots of options to consider.
Great. And I think there were a couple of pharmacies that were doing rebates and or refunds on any canceled cycles that happened in March and April due to the COVID shutdown or the government shutdown. So I think looking into those would be helpful as well. Any final thoughts, Dr. Amy or Dr. Duke, about key things that patients should be thinking about at this time?
No, I mean, I think it's a great time to regroup with your fertility doctor and come up with a plan. But there's no better time than now. A lot of patients are waiting for their clinic to call them, but I can tell you that everyone is really busy. Even though the clinic might not be full of patients in the way it used to be, they're very busy planning things out to make things safe for patients. So it's important to reach out to them. So don't feel like you're bothering anyone by reaching out. There's no better time than now.
I endorse that too. And, you know, keep in mind that some clinics also are working with decreased staff compared to usual. And so, honestly, I endorse what Dr. Amy says. Contact your clinic, email them, call them. I don't think they'll be upset to hear from you. They want to hear from you. And also, this information is changing fast. If you come across information that you're not sure about, you know, contact your clinic and ask, what's your thought on this? How is my clinic? How are you coping with this particular issue? Oh, is it real? Is it not?
Great. Shreera, I'll pass it back to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Amy, you have further questions for the doctors?
Sure. I have a few more we can, since we have a little bit of time. So for Dr. Amy, you know, I think most of us, last week was a big week, and this week has been a big week for clinic reopenings, and we are elated that we've been able to resume infertility care in a lot of areas. Obviously, it's very location dependent, and there are still some, you know, guidelines that need to be followed. How much longer do you think it will be until we can kind of get back up and running, you know, 100%, getting everybody in? We have younger patients that, you know, maybe they're not, say, 43 with, you know, a really bad ovarian reserve like somebody over here, but they're, you know, 32 and they have a bad ovarian reserve, and they, although may not be critical, it is very tough for them to wait this out as well.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter your situation. It's really hard. So I would say July, August, September is when most clinics will probably be up and running, especially for patients who are younger, donor egg cycles. Some people in June, less folks in May. And then the reason why I'm giving an end point, because we just don't know what's going to happen in the winter months with influenza.
Sure.
Is there going to be another surge of cases? And so that's why, you know, plan your cycles, I think, over the summer as much as you can is kind of what I'm recommending to people.
Okay, that makes sense. I know that we've definitely heard talk that, you know, if COVID were to resurge, people are very afraid that the shutdown would happen all over again. And, you know, that's very concerning in trying to get things restarted. So
right.
Hopefully
yeah.
that doesn't come to fruition, but I think that's what you said is great advice.
Yeah.
For Dr. Duke, let's see what else I had to ask. Kind of a touchy topic, but, you know, the thing that I hear a lot from women that have been put on pause during this is that if, you know, all pregnant women haven't been told to stop trying, and there's not these announcements such as there were during Zika that, you know, this is dangerous for all pregnant women, why are, you know, fertility treatments being put on pause? And do you feel that that is somewhat discriminatory towards women with infertility versus those without?
I don't think the initial guidelines were discriminatory. I actually really do agree with Dr. Amy and the task force in that very moment, the healthcare system was being overwhelmed. We had an extreme shortage of resources. We also did not have very clear data on how infectious this virus was, how infectious it was across different patient populations, and also how dangerous it would be for patients if they were to develop complications from their fertility treatments and needed to go to the hospital. So as physicians, we do have a ethical responsibility, not just to the patients, but to ourselves, our staff, and the community at large. I think the revision made so far to the guidance and the guidelines also makes sense. I think it should be patient, doctor, and region-based, because we are seeing that some regions are more hard hit than others. Some regions have more access to resources than others. You know, separate from the fertility issue, I do think it shouldn't be that case. We should all have equal access, but that is not the case right now. So if the prevalence of the disease has dropped to a point where, you know, not that many people are being exposed to the virus anymore, if we're seeing good compliance and adherence within different regions, that people are following the safety guidelines, even practicing it at the clinic, if the clinics can get a hold of testing so they also have a way to quickly determine who's positive or not, I say then it seems safer to move forward. But with a caveat, though, because some patients are truly high risk for COVID-19, even though they're younger, even though they're reproductive age, we do have some patients. I have some patients who have underlying medical issues that I personally call them and recommended that we wait out a couple more months until there's a better handle on the infection rate and a better understanding of the medical treatment options, so that if that person were to become infected, there are options to help preventing them from getting very sick. So I wouldn't say it's a story, but I think I'm concerned that some clinics might be feeling that their hands are so tied that they must get a complete clearance from ASRM, as opposed to what ASRM is saying, which is look at your individual region, look at your patient population, counsel your patients on what you know and what we don't know, because there's still a lot that we don't know, but there's a lot of reassuring stuff that we can counsel patients on as well.
Okay, that sounds great. I think that, you know, you bring up a wonderful point that there are going to be patients, unfortunately, that are high risk, and we are all so different in our needs and our risk stratification. So I appreciate your point of view. I will hand it back over to Shweta to ask any questions or move on with the program.
Thank you. Sure. Thanks a lot, Amy. It was nice listening to your discussion with Dr. Duke and Dr. Amy. Dr. Duke, Dr. Amy, we have a couple of questions coming in posted on our page. I'll just read it out for you both to answer. The first one says, are fertility doctors looking into highly individualized egg retrieval method for women over 45?
Yeah, so for those who don't know what that means, that's related to a type of retrieval where basically you're retrieving eggs at a smaller diameter. So typically we like to grow follicles mm-hmm. over 18 millimeters. And with this mm-hmm. approach, this doctor who's published this study in their group find that they have really good success for women over a certain age when the follicles are 16 to 18 millimeters. And what I'll tell you is that this approach is, I mean, IVF isn't one size fits all. We all cook cookies
right.
a different way. We always make different momlets. And so what
I
one
agree.
Doctor thinks really mm-hmm. works for them, that doesn't work for me. And so I don't think it's fair mm-hmm. to say this is the way that all women over 40 should be cared for. I have really good luck getting really beautiful eggs from women when their follicles are triggered at 20 millimeters and they're over mm-hmm. 43. I've even retrieved eggs from women who are 50 and 51. I have made an embryo for women between 49 and 51
wow.
with their own eggs. They were
yeah.
not normal embryos, but I've
no.
done it. So I'm not gonna then say, oh, I should start triggering people at 16 or at 13 to 15 mm-hmm. millimeters. No, but I do get it. Some women are at higher risk of having a premature ovulation, and that's like a really bad day when you do an egg retrieval and there are no eggs. So mm-hmm. I would do that retrieval take that approach. If the doctor you're using, that's their
mm-hmm.
special sauce. If that's what gives their patient success, you want to do that. But don't make
mm-hmm.
your doctor, who doesn't believe in that, like don't ask your doctor to trigger you at 13 millimeters because of the study that you read by one clinic is kind of what my recommendation would be.
I agree with that. And I would say I echo Dr. Amy because I have patients also who are under 40 where I had to trigger them a little bit earlier because they were moving so much faster, so much differently. And the converse is true for people over 40. So it's not the key word here is individualized. So individualized means not every patient over 40 is going to need this particular protocol applied to them. And it's important to understand that as a patient because your doctor is looking at a gestalt, as we call it. They're looking at your overall response. They're looking at your hormone levels. They're looking at the follicle sizes. Mm-hmm. They're looking at a number of things, plus the medications may be different as well. And so I would say if it's your first cycle, especially, allow your doctor to learn what's happening for you. Sometimes that first cycle mm-hmm. is more informative than any paper can ever be for any patient.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for that answer, doctors. The second question says, I believe it's from the same person. What are you looking for in women age 47 to 49 wanting to use OE? And what would you recommend?
I'll jump in. I mean, for women who want to use their own eggs at 47 to 49, they need to have realistic expectations. That's what I'm looking for. I'm not going to mm-hmm. help a woman who's 47 to 49 if she thinks that it's going to work. You know, the likelihood of it working with her own eggs is around, mm-hmm. you know, 0.001%.
Under 1%.
I think that's what.
Well under 1%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Point, and so it's like 99.999999, and I can go on and on. It's not going to work. But there are
yes.
so many people mm-hmm. who need that closure. They need to feel like they gave
mm-hmm.
themselves a
mm-hmm.
chance so that they don't
mm-hmm.
ruminate about what would have happened if I used my own eggs.
Yes.
So I think it's very fair for doctors to give patients that option and choice. I think it's unfair to say, no, I won't let you because George Clooney can have a baby at 50. you know, all these
yes.
celebrities, men can, and women say, oh, it's so cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm
mm-hmm.
not saying, oh, it's so cute. I'm saying good for him. But why are we shaming women who are young
yeah.
at 47 into using their own eggs? So it's just important
mm-hmm.
to have realistic expectations. So that's what I'm looking for. No
Agreed.
Matter what your AMH is, no matter what your FSH is, that's what you need.
Mm-hmm. And that's the key word, managing expectations and also understanding that this may well be for closure. And I don't think many patients truly understand that. The other is I sit down with my patients who are this age or over 50, and I ask them to think about one honest question, which is how much are you in terms of able to dedicate to your dream? Because if your goal is a take-home baby and you have a very finite amount of funds to achieve that goal, then we also consider what is it that this funds will get me? Is it my take-home baby or is it closure? The take-home baby, that's
right.
why donor oocyte may make
mm-hmm.
more sense.
Right. Okay, thank you so much for that answer. I believe the follow-up question you already answered for her. And we have also reached the end of our scheduled time for this show now. So thank you so much for your answers. I'll wind up the show now. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed the lives of many in different ways. For the folks in the infertility community, they are dealing with added uncertainty, emotional upheavals, and concerns about when will they be able to resume infertility treatment, and when they do so, how will it be different from pre-COVID times. We heard Dr. Cindy Duke and Dr. Amy discuss the changing recommendations in the field and share about the extra precautions that will be needed when we get back to the infertility treatments again. We hope people will be able to get back on their paths to family building very soon. Dr. Duke, Dr. Amy, thank you so very much for your time and all the information that you shared with us today. Amy, Valerie, and the audience, thank you for your participation and your very insightful questions that brought out a very informative discussion today. The talk will be available on curetalks.com. Please visit our website for details on the upcoming talks. Until next time, wish you all well and stay safe, everyone. Thank you and have a great day. Bye-bye.